I'm Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey, you guys.
Hello.
Hello from Antarctica.
Oh my gosh, for real. Burr. Welcome or welcome back to About Time for True Crime, your favorite true crime podcast.
Oh.
Oh.
You guys.
We are ice cubes.
We're freezing.
So fucking cold.
Here in New England, it is, how you say, fucking cold.
Yeah, I think that is actually what was on the Weather Channel today.
For sure.
It's fucking cold.
And it was brrr.
G-brr.
Yeah, that was it. So my car read -7.
Eek.
This morning, eek. Which was oh so lovely.
Mm.
And there was, if I wasn't running late, I would have got an iced coffee.
Yep.
I would have hit my Dunks and I would have gotten myself an iced coffee. Or what my new thing is,
mm-hmm.
I think I've shared. The frozen caramel coffee.
Ooh, it's, you are into that shit right now.
Basically just a caramel shake.
Yeah.
Like it's ice cream. I don't know why, like the word coffee is used oh so loosely.
So loose.
Because it is just an ice cream. And then of course I get it with whipped cream and like they charge you extra for it and then they hand it to you without whipped cream. And I'm like,
okay, rude.
I'm like, but we're into whipped cream.
But it's for the whippies.
And you knew it. Like, I saw you put it down, and it hasn't been that long since I said it and I got here. Like, this was really quick.
Oh my gosh. Did they give it to you, though? You eat it and not say anything?
It goes either way.
Okay.
I'm a mixed bag. I hate being that person.
Yeah. But sometimes you need the whippies.
But also sometimes, like, if I've paid for something and it, like, I'm not mean about it and no, I understand it might take some time. But also, like,
but please.
But I mean, yeah, like, I provided money. You provided the good. I feel like we can both benefit from this transaction.
Yep. In fact, you have.
And I feel like I have been stiffed a bit and I don't love that.
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know.
I will say,
I take a whole can of whipped cream. You know me. So
I
like
do
to,
know that about you.
You think I'm swatting that away? Are you kidding
hell
me?
Hell no.
Oh, hell nah.
If they could give you a side of a whipped cream bottle, you'd take it.
I'd get a pup cup for myself.
I know that about you.
Which is a PSA to get all of the pod pets a little pup cup.
Little cuppies for the puppies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of, if you wanted to see any pod pets or send yours in, you could do that at our Instagram, which is below in our link tree. Ooh. Actually, you should probably get familiar with that because I'm going to suggest you go and look at it for today's case as well. Because you always get like all the people, places and things we talk about. But today's is particularly hard. So I feel like it's good to see who we're talking about.
I made an entire highlight of all of the individual photos of all of the pod pets so that having a day, you can just click through and see all of them. Like not just the posts that have like 10 photos in them. You can see each individual pod pet. And if I missed any, I am so sorry. But I put them all in the stories and then I had to go through and highlight them all.
Yeah.
I act as if that was super laborious, but it was not.
Also, you guys are finding out, if you didn't know before from my reactions, Allie does our Instagram. So anything that's there, please say thank you and give her little nose boops because it's all her and it's so fucking good.
Well, I'm also sorry if you ever log into the account. I mean, you have the account, but you don't go on it much. But it's all curated for me now. Like the algorithm has like, it's
sometimes
all baby animals and like quick lunch recipes. And I'm like,
well, the thing
I'm liking it on this account. I was like, no, show that to me on my main.
I know you and I share one brain cell because that is obviously not far away from my algorithm. And there are times that I'll go on just to like, see what's new, check it out. And then it doesn't log me back to mine. Like it doesn't transfer the account right away. And so then I see things and I'm like, haha, I like that. Who is that? And then I'm like, oh my God, this isn't even mine.
Seriously.
This isn't even mine. And I'm not even the one running it.
So if that happens, my apologies. I've liked some like little baby ducky videos.
Yeah, I love those.
So I'm a 5-year-old. I don't even care.
We are.
I think
it's good.
I think all things are cute, but I also have the humor of an 8-year-old boy.
Yes, that is also true about you. One of your favorite, can I out you?
Sure.
One of Allie's favorite things to do is watch YouTube compilations of people who fall, which is why her and I are such good friends, because I'm a real life YouTube compilation of people who fall.
She really is.
You just get to laugh constantly. And I fell today, actually. I did. I forgot about that. It's so common for me that I did that today.
I'd be surprised if you didn't fall today.
It was icy and it was cold and that didn't make me happier. And yes, I saved the coffee.
As you always do. I love that about you. One thing you gotta know about Abby is everything. I saved
my iced coffee on this -7 degree day.
It's going to, whatever she's holding when she falls, it's gonna be fine. Her knees, back, toes, anything else?
Yeah.
Not guaranteed.
No. Nope. No, I'll take the hit before I'll let the coffee take the hit.
But I'll say this. I don't like people getting like hurt.
No.
I'm not like, oh, let me see that get dislocated. Like I will like feel that in my bones and I will cringe away. But there is something so funny, or like when karma hits, like someone is really mean to somebody and then they turn around and they walk into a pole.
Yep.
I'm like that. Instant. Like, yeah. I love that shit.
Thanks, universe.
That's just... Ugh. Yeah. So anyway, if you want to have a good night, you should you should look up some of those. If one of them doesn't make you laugh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. Even I laugh at them and I get like painfully empathetic.
It's not your thing, but when we watch it together, we can crack up. So I'm telling you, in the right company...
It does the trick. It does the trick.
Yes. But yes, I've been outed. So now you know that about me.
And now you get, well, I say now you guys know that I fall all the time. Like it's not a canon event in my life that happens every other day, but now you know.
Well, it's why we're friends, because I always need that.
It is a good compatibility thing for us.
Works out.
I do want to get into today. Today's going to be hard.
Okay.
When I researched this, I did have one like cry outburst.
Oh.
But by the end of it, it was just a constant stream.
All right.
So I'm going to let you guys hear that so that you know what you're in for. Unfortunately, Allie does not get to skip this one or move past it.
No, I don't even know what we're talking about today. No. You guys know because you clicked it. But when we do this, this is the honest reaction.
Yes. So today we're actually talking about the Cheshire home invasion and triple homicide.
Yeah, that was not on my bingo card.
No, but it wasn't. But today, as always, we'll start with sources and trigger warnings. For sources, I used a documentary from HBO Max called The Cheshire Murders.
Ooh.
I also used a lot from New York Times, Wikipedia, NBC Connecticut, ABC, and more. There was actually a really phenomenal article on Medium.com that laid out some of the history that we'll talk about. So I'd recommend that. And I really do recommend the documentary. It's 2 hours. Excellent. Gets really thorough. But for trigger warnings today, we are talking about a home invasion, a violent triple homicide, rape, sexual assault on a minor, and arson. Please proceed with caution. This is not an easy case.
And you didn't leave anything out, huh?
No. January and February tend to be a rough month for people anyway because of that big sad.
Mm.
So if you need to sit this one out, this isn't one that I'm like, yeah, that could be rough. This is rough. Like if you need to sit it out, sit it out.
It will be here when you're ready for it. But if you are raw dogging life like I am, let's get into it.
All right. So a yoo-hoo, pod's on.
Yay.
It's time. So lock in, buckle up.
It's about time.
It is about damn time.
In a minute, I'm Anita. Do, 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 do.
So today, because it's me, because why wouldn't I do this?
Mm.
I wanted to start this case by asking you about the American dream.
Oh, hell.
It's sort of a concept that those of us who grew up in the States had to think about a lot, from essays in high school on books and literary analysis to religious songs about the American dream and its lack of fulfillment in your spiritual life to immigrants who came over striving for this dream or their own. Typically, this dream comes with the ability to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, to find financial success in a career you love and are fulfilled by, while being surrounded by people that you love and are fulfilled by.
Yes.
And well, today, we're talking about the people that seem to have the American dream figured out. We're talking about William Pettit, who went by Bill. And Bill was a man who had it all at the time. He had a pretty great life, in fact. He grew up in Plainville, Connecticut, and he ended up going to prestigious schools for his undergrad and graduate degrees, spending time at both Dartmouth and Yale, before settling into his life as a doctor, working in areas of private practice and hospitals. And in 2007, when our case takes place, Dr. Pettit was the director of public health in Plainville, Connecticut.
Dang, and a New Englander.
And a New Englander.
Okay.
Bill, who occasionally went by Billy to his friends and family, wasn't just living that part of the American dream either, though. He had a beautiful wife, Jennifer Hawk, who had just the kindest eyes and the sweetest smile I'd ever seen in my life. They actually met in, I believe it was a hospital that they worked in, and he tried to correct her on how to take blood pressure because she was a pediatrics nurse.
Oh, my.
And he was like a third year med student, and she had been working as a nurse, and she was like, I got this. And he was like, yeah, it became very clear to me that she knew a whole hell of a lot more than I did. And I was like, attaboy.
Yes.
But
don't tell a nurse how to do her job.
Hell no. They're just so sweet. And they are exactly the kind of people that you think would find each other. They're passionate. They have huge hearts. They are sort of equally STEM brained, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yep.
And also, they were such advocates for social justice and justice as a whole, as a family.
Mm-hmm.
They had been married for just over 20 years in 2007 with two very sweet daughters. There was 17-year-old Haley Elizabeth and 11-year-old Michaela Rose.
Okay, 17 and 11. Okay.
Yes. This whole family was beautiful and personable. And Jen and Bill were kind of the people that were winning at life for a long time,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better phrase, really. I mean, they both had jobs that they loved. They had jobs that paid well so they could afford a nice life.
Mm-hmm.
They had two daughters that were so sweet and so kind. Haley was so humble, but she got straight A's. She was like the captain of a bunch of her sports teams. I think she was on a rowing team I saw photos of.
Okay.
And earlier in her life, I believe when Haley was in middle school, Jen got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
Oh.
And Haley actually did a ton because she wanted to help her mom so bad. She became a spokesperson for an MS society in Connecticut and rose over $50,000.
Wow.
Yeah. As a child.
That's incredible.
It's insane. And old schoolmates and people who knew her always said that she was so quiet, she kept to herself. Like, she had all of these things to brag about, and she never said a word.
Those are the best kinds of people.
Right? Or at least never said a word about it. You know what I mean? It was never boastful.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you don't think that the world owes you, you know, congratulations and...
Right.
That you're so incredible and amazing, and everyone should be just, oh, so lucky to hear your voice.
Well, and... how caring that she said, I need to do something to help my mom.
Yeah, it's a testament to her mom, too. Yeah. Like, how they raised their kids, but also how good of a mom she had that she was like, no,
this is what I'm
not going to sit here and do nothing.
Right. Her sister, Michaela, who was 11, had the biggest heart. Her teachers said that she was always the kid that if someone was excluded, she was going and sitting with them. If someone was having a bad day, she was the one to go make them feel better.
Mm.
I mean, she's 11. 11 is the age that, like, most kids cognitively develop empathy, but it seemed like this was significantly before that for her, like a true empath to her soul. And she was just a delight, and you could see her really blooming. I mean, she did get a little bit quiet and maybe shied away from some adults for a little bit, but like, what 11-year-old doesn't?
No, in fact, that's like middle school when you really become an asshole. So right. She's doing amazing.
She's doing great. This whole family, the Pettit family, was known in their community for their sense of sociability and justice, and they were just such a pillar of it in so many different ways. But I'm going to leave the Pettit family here for now, sitting in this happy bubble.
Mm.
Because we're going to talk about some bros. Regrettably. We're going back in time to the year prior, 2006.
What's his name and why is it Chad?
Oh my gosh, so close. Josh.
Mm.
Very, it's the same vibe though.
Yeah, Chad and Brad.
Chad and Brad and Brent. Sorry if any of you guys have those names. It's not about you. We're just trying to make fun of these people.
Yep.
Yeah. But it's 2006. We're in a Hartford drug treatment center.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who has worked in the criminal justice field, as well as the field with behaviorally challenged kids and families at different points in my career, I can tell you a few things I know for a fact about our systems in the criminal justice and mental health system. There's a lot that I can tell you that I'm not going to go into today. But today, what matters most and what truth I want to share with you is that no matter which system you're in, you never choose your roommate. In a psych hospital for a residential treatment or involuntary admission, you might get put in there for something like OCD or compulsions related to germs or dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And your roommate? Well, so sorry. They're actually so clinically depressed. They haven't been able to shower in months. Have fun.
Or you could be roomed with Morgan Geyser.
Oh, yeah.
Who, yeah, you know, the Slender Man case. But actually, you won't, because she's getting out.
She is getting out.
So, fun fact.
But, you know, that incompatibility doesn't really mean a lot to anybody unless it's causing issues.
Yep. Nope. You just get lumped in.
You get what you get. You could be in a prison, and maybe your bunkie is the uncle of your victim who's in there for his own shit. And unless you guys are a safety risk to yourself or others, sorry. Bye. Deal with it. Sometimes, as I just highlighted with a few examples, this can be disastrous. Roommates are a real mixed bag.
They can be.
But sometimes, this can be magic. It can connect people who never would have met or had the opportunity outside. Maybe you meet your best friend at the psych hospital and you both get a different part of each other that nobody else does. Maybe you go to a halfway house coming out of prison and meet the love of your life. Who knows? But or maybe, in a sick twist of fate, it's both catastrophic and euphoric all at once.
Ooh.
In my opinion, this seemed to be the case at that Hartford Drug Treatment Center in 2006, when 45-year-old Stephen Hayes roomed with 26-year-old Joshua Komisarjevsky.
Was he like, hey, dad?
Right. Right. They were both seemingly taking sobriety very seriously together, going to Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and they were talking together daily. Steve was really well-versed in recovery. He knew the NA book like front to back.
But he was in a residential program?
He was in a recovery treatment halfway house, yeah.
Gotcha.
Josh seemed to like this, at least from accounts of the counselors there and people that knew them. It seemed like part of what pulled him to Steve was that he was so serious and he knew so much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew sort of the gravity of addiction and some of the difficulties maintaining that. And Josh seemed like he really wanted to get back on the right foot. In May of 2007, both were released from the halfway house and kind of went different ways for a little bit. As many people in the recovery scene know, that population or that sample of people that are in active recovery isn't usually huge and ever-changing unless you're in like a major city.
Mm-hmm.
So they would run into each other from time to time, but mostly they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, you might see each other at meetings.
Right. From May to July, Steve lived with his mother and brother in a one-bedroom apartment. Steve was 46 and had been in and out of incarceration and recovery for a really long time. His own brothers remember him as deceptive and manipulative, and neither were really fond of him being around. Steve seemed to have lifelong issues with controlling himself and hurting others. Josh, on the other hand, had other problems. See, Josh was adopted, and I'm not entirely sure how this relates in the HBO documentary because they talked to his uncle, but I believe Josh was adopted. So I don't know if that's his bio uncle or adopted family uncle.
Well, yeah, and sometimes if you get adopted by a family member,
yeah,
too.
Yes.
It could still be related, but maybe not biologically uncle.
Right. So I'm not entirely sure all of the connections in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that family that he grew up with was also related to like a Russian princess.
Ooh.
So he came from like quite the background, at least over in Russia. They were all very artistically talented. I think one of their aunts or uncles wrote like music for plays and operas in Russia. There was like an opera house named after her. It was very interesting. Hmm. But Josh did not get to live that high life. Regardless of who he was adopted by, there's reports of him being sexually abused as a kid and growing up in a really strict religious background where he was essentially told that homosexuality was like the peak of all sins. And because he had been abused by a man, he believed that he was essentially one of the greatest sinners there ever was.
Oh, come on.
Which, for the sake of saying it, is not true. That's not how that works. You're not picking that if you're being assaulted by someone. And if you are at a place where someone is telling you that that is going to cause eternal damnation because you were the victim of something, I think it's worth talking to a trusted adult about. Or a few.
Yeah, and the whole like homophobia of it all is really fucking shitty.
Yeah, that part's shitty, but that's not as surprising to me as the fact that they said, well, kid, have you been abused since you were like 5? Yeah, that's kind of on you, huh?
So maybe that's why he was taken from that family, and maybe that's why he was adopted, to get out of that.
Perhaps.
Okay, so he was a little older maybe when he was adopted?
I think he was like 3.
Oh.
Yeah.
So this was in his adopted home.
Allegedly.
Okay.
Now, there have been reports from people he went to church with that talked a lot about his anxiety and like panic disorders. And mm-hmm. It sounded like that was really what it was. But whatever the specific church that he went to, they kind of claimed that this was the devil using his body as a vessel.
Oh, come on.
So he had like an exorcism at one point, I think. He had a girlfriend for like 2 years that they didn't do anything because it was so frowned upon for them to have like any sexual activity before marriage. But he had like a panic attack one night, I think, at a retreat or conference that they all went to. And I think he actually got kind of excommunicated for trying to go into a room to like calm down.
No.
So he was failed in a lot of different ways. That makes none of what he did okay.
But if he was, so he's abused and traumatized and ideologically confused,
yes,
and struggling with mental health and getting pushed away from the religious community that he, I don't know, at least felt comfortable with partially.
Right. And it's not that he didn't want to get help. He asked for it. And his parents just kept sending him to more church things. So I believe that they were trying to do the right thing, and I believe that he thought that that was the right thing, and that because that wasn't going well for him, he must be truly evil. There must be something truly intrinsically wrong with him, which is hard.
And so we don't think one of his parents was abusing him.
I don't believe so, but okay. I don't know more about that.
Okay.
I was, frankly, in all honesty, I took the information I had from that documentary and from the Medium article that mm-hmm. I read, and everything else he did disgusted me so much, I had to spend as little time on him as I could.
Makes sense.
He is someone that is a prime example of you feel for the kid, but the choices he made as an adult.
Nope, none of it excuses it. It might
explain, I'm lost for words.
Might explain some of it, but it's never an excuse.
It's good context. It's not anything other than that, though. But Josh had also had a history of burglaries.
Josh.
Josh, in juxtaposition to Steve, is such an interesting visual to me. Because Steve is like 45. He's had a history of things, but it's mostly theft. He'll like follow people until they go out for a walk, and then he'll steal things in their car kind of guy.
Mm.
And that takes planning. That takes work. But mostly, Steve seemed like he was really struggling with his own mental health. He had been diagnosed with like gender dysphoria since the time he was 16. He had never been treated for it at the time he was still going by Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh was like fucking brilliant. For everything he had going on, he had like a photographic memory, and he loved burglarizing. He loved that specifically, breaking into people's homes, taking things and leaving.
Yeah, there's a power involved in that, especially to enjoy it.
Yes. And he was regrettably fucking good at it.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know, violation kink. I don't know another way to put it, but like, yes, that power and control dynamic of like, I can enter your home and do things to your home and you wouldn't know it, and you'll come home and find that. And that sort of like violating feeling when you come home and someone else has been there. Like, you, it smells different, it looks different, it feels different. There could, things could be misplaced, or you remember you didn't put that there.
He was so good at it, he'd do it while people were home.
What?
He's broken into state troopers' homes.
What?
Yeah. And he has such an active brain. His memory is so good, they call it photographic. I don't know how real that is, but he could tell you what a note said that he took out of one specific pocket on one specific pair of pants, the way it was laying in the corner of what room he took it in, and then what dumpster he threw it out in.
Why would you use your power for evil?
Truly.
You know, I can't remember shit I did yesterday. I would kill for that. Are you kidding me?
My executive function would be so good. Oh. It'd be so over for you bitches if I could remember what I needed from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Josh's old counselor recounts him as a young man who just wanted to stay sober while he was in this treatment center. He wanted to stay sober, focus on his family, and he even was considering going back to school for architecture. He had like a real knack for it and a really strong passion for it. He'd make the most elaborate like sketches of different architecture plans that he could do, and they were beautiful. Of course, Josh wanted more in life too. He wanted to get married, and he met this girl who I'm going to leave out of this. She is in the documentary if you want to see it, but she looked quite young.
Not the same girlfriend he was caught trying to sneak into the room of?
No.
Okay.
I think there was a good 7 or 8 years between those two, but the girl that he wanted to get married to, her father was a pastor, and he called him up and he said, "Hey, I want to marry your daughter."
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor said, "Hey, I have two concerns with this. The first is that you are a career criminal.
And the second is you are too old.
And the second is I think you're a pedophile."
Yeah, well, that's a way to put it. Oh, shit. Okay, so she's a baby.
Because I think was old enough, but she looked very young. Visually, she looked very young. And he did not blink an eye. His tone of voice did not change. He said, "Well, I'm sorry you think that."
Well, if he's in his 20s and she is anything under 18.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got problems.
So on Friday, July 20th of 2007, things at home had been really boiling over for Steve. There had been altercations with his brothers, a fight that left one of his brothers with a black eye and 3 broken ribs.
Ooh.
And some less than full truths that were coming around to bite him in his little butt. Mm-hmm. Steve's mom told him to get out of her house. She didn't really care if that meant he went back to a halfway house, if he went to live with a friend. She didn't care. She just didn't want him there anymore.
Gotcha.
Get. And according to Steve, this is when things go kind of south for him in his recovery. He goes and he buys a bunch of drugs. He gets a hotel or a motel room for the night, and he locks himself in the bathroom with crack cocaine and heroin with the intent to binge on these drugs and overdose with the hopes of taking his own life. Now, people don't talk about this a lot as a way of taking your own life, as a means of suicidality, but people will try to overdose sometimes for this. And that was exactly Steve's intent, but it did not take. He did not end up dying from this overdose. I think he had a really fucked up night in a bathroom, and he ended up stumbling into an AA meeting. And that's where he ran into Josh again.
Wow. So he went to the AA meeting. Hi.
I believe so.
Wow. Okay.
They commiserate over how hard life is. And Josh is like, "Yeah, you know, I need some cash. I have this girl I really like. Her family moved. I'd like to get her back up here. I want a good life. I want to go to school. But man, it's so expensive. It's expensive." And Steve's like, "Yeah, well, my life is pretty shit. I could use some money. I don't have a place to live right now."
Uh-oh.
And so the two eventually decide that they will commit another burglary together as a pair.
All right.
But they wanted to do a little prep for a bit. So over the next few days, they made some plans. They talked about what to do. At some point, they did spot two people that they followed into a Stop and Shop. And I want to believe that this happened earlier in the timeline, so like this weekend, but it might have truly been the day of. So okay. Either way, they're kind of casing neighborhoods. They're trying to find a place. They do a practice run. They don't steal anything. They just break into a place.
Oh my God.
You know, get the juices flowing.
What year is this?
2007.
So not fully the era of everyone has a home security system. No. And cameras and live feed and all that stuff.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And it was easy. And for someone as smart as Josh, it was too easy. And so he said, good, I'm ready to go. I'm in it.
I hate
Let's
that.
Fucking do it. So on July 22nd, the two went out, got an air rifle and rope, and ended up seeing a pair of two beautiful women walking into a Stop and Shop. Unfortunately, I have to stop here and give you all a giant big trigger warning. This is disgusting. What I'm about to tell you, it's really hard. It's graphic. We'll be here next week. We'll be here if you want to come back to it, but it's rough. Because this is where we get reintroduced to the Pettit family.
Okay.
See, unfortunately, the two beautiful women in this Stop and Shop weren't two beautiful women at all, but one beautiful woman and her 11-year-old daughter.
Okay.
Jen and Michaela had gone into the store to grab some supplies for dinner, and Josh thought that Michaela, the 11-year-old, was rather pretty. And this is how they decided to pick up the Pettit family to rob. They cased the house. They thought it looked perfect. They stalked them on the way home from the Stop and Shop, and they waited. Bill, Jen, Haley, and Michaela had a good night. They chilled out. They did their normal thing. The girls went to sleep. Bill, I'm sure, was quote unquote resting his eyes, watching TV, and fell asleep on the couch with the TV on.
Yep.
And that is the house that Josh and Steve broke into at 3 a.m. in a window into their home.
Oh, that's so terrifying.
Without knowing exactly why, because Josh had broken in and burglarized multiple homes before, while being undetected with people asleep, this threw him for a loop. He wasn't expecting Bill to be asleep on the couch. And so for one reason or another, he decided to bash Bill's head with a baseball bat.
What?
Mm-hmm. Bill awoke, terrified and confused, and Josh continued to hit him in the head.
Ugh.
Later, Bill was found to have 6 to 8 wounds on his skull, all 3 to 4 inches long.
Oh my goodness.
The two men bound Bill and brought him downstairs to the basement, where they tied his arms and legs around like kind of a pipe or support beam.
Mm-hmm.
They were so fucking thoughtful, though, because they did give him a pillow for his head. So there's that. Josh and Steven then decided to go upstairs. They found Jen and Michaela asleep in the same bed. Michaela had fallen asleep reading Harry Potter next to her mom, and Haley was in her own bed asleep. But that didn't stop Josh and Steve from putting pillowcases over each of them, tying them up, and then binding them each to their own beds separately. But there was a slight hiccup. See, Josh and Steve saw this house. They knew this family had wealth and cash.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, that's a big house.
Mm-hmm.
And they were convinced that there would be like a safe or something with jewels and fat stacks of cash.
Mm-hmm.
Except it's not so much, because it's fucking 2007 in Connecticut in America. And these are people that use banks.
Mm-hmm.
So no pile of rubies there, you know?
You hate to see it.
You hate to see it. It was really disappointing, actually, because they did all this work. Everybody's tied up. You know,
I'm sure you could find something of value, but that just tells me that's not why you went there.
Mm. And so they ransacked the house. They said, we got to find something. There's got to be something here. And they didn't really find anything. But what they did find was a checkbook from Jen's purse with like obvious notations that they had tens of thousands of dollars ready at any given time. So they came up with a plan B, if you will. to make Jen go withdraw a bunch of cash from the bank at 9 a.m. when it opened. In the meantime, they decided that they would be really nice and they wouldn't disturb the family any further. They were just going to hang out and get drunk on Bill's beers and bide their time.
While everyone's tied up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, you know, I guess that's not fully true. They did have an errand because they did go to a gas station and get like 2 gallons of gas or so.
That is so weird.
So weird. But they came back, hours passed, the beers came and went, and 9 a.m. arrived. You know, so that was good.
Perfect.
The men forced Jen into the car, and Josh stayed back while Steve took her to the bank. Steve drove and told Jen that if she didn't come back with the $15,000 they were asking for in cash, or if the police were notified at all, that he would make sure her children were murdered. Jen went into the bank. And there's camera footage that you can see from this. She is petrified. She looks like a woman who hasn't been asleep in hours because she hasn't been with men who are threatening to murder her children. And though she remained relatively calm, her eyes were dark and sunken. And she told the teller what was happening. She said, hey, I need to get $15,000 out here. I know that's a lot of money. I know that's kind of weird. I know there's probably a process for this, but there are 2 men that are holding my family captive. And they say they're going to murder them if I don't. And it's okay, though, because they're being really nice. I think they just want the money and then they'll leave us alone. And Jen ran into a few problems because, like I said, that's a huge amount of money to just take out. And also the bank wouldn't let her take it out without Bill there. I assume he was like the head on the account or something.
Gotcha.
But when Jen explained this to the bank manager said, like, mother to mother, I knew she wasn't lying to me. Like, I could see in her eyes that that was true. She helped her come up with a way to loan out the cash. I mean, obviously the family had it. So the bank ended up giving her, I think, 3 $5,000 loans.
Wow.
So that she could give them the cash.
But nobody's called the police yet.
The bank is the first place to call the police.
Okay.
And yet, despite police being around, despite police being near their house, despite police seeing the car turn out of the bank, nobody stopped this. Nobody pulled them over, asked what was going on. And I know that there's protocols and processes for all of these things, but this has been brought up in multiple sources.
But you do a SWAT raid of the house.
Yeah, on multiple different articles and platforms, and nobody quite understands why this didn't happen, but it didn't. Now, that should have been it, right? They got their money. Nobody's hurt. Let's all go home. But when they arrived back, Josh told Steve that something else not according to plan happened. He had assaulted Michaela.
The 11-year-old.
He said he performed, just giant fucking trigger warning here, so sorry. He said he performed oral on her and then posed her in lewd posings on the bed while he masturbated and took a lot of pictures. But he also said that there was no rape. And I hate to argue semantics here.
But it is.
And sure, he's alleging, and we know formally lying, about not having raped her in the terms of vaginal sex. But I think at this point, what he was claiming to have done anyway is still rape.
Mm-hmm.
The total and utter unconsenting control of someone for your own sexual pleasure is fucking rape to me. So, that's an 11-year-old.
That is a baby.
And rest assured, we know from the autopsies later that she did have semen in her. So he is just a fucking liar.
But on top of everything else,
if I'm gonna argue semantics, he's still lying, even if he's telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And now, this is a case and a specific detail that will haunt me. I thought about this a lot. I cried about this a lot. I don't know how you do that to anyone. But I don't know how you do that to an 11-year-old. And I don't know how you fucking enjoy it and then take pictures for later. That it. They literally later had to stop the trial because the jury members couldn't get through these pictures. Like, they had to break for the day because it was too much.
Of course.
It's a fucking baby. But if that wasn't bad enough, Josh convinced Steve that he then had to even the score by raping Jen. Worse yet, Steve listened. Steve raped Jen on the living room floor, almost directly above Bill.
Oh my God.
Tied, losing significant blood and semi-conscious. He had to hear all of that. Bill had to hear his wife scream and cry and the thuds of the violence of what was happening directly above him, and he couldn't do anything about it. And Bill was semi-conscious. He was losing so much blood that even if he knew that he was hearing that, I don't think he knew what he was hearing.
But the helplessness of that, like when we talk about these, and yeah, they had to go through it so we can talk about it, but when you imagine what it was like to be him,
yeah,
take 5 minutes of that. The rage,
despair,
the helplessness, the disgust, the shock.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine it, and they don't even know what happened upstairs.
No. He has no idea the details of what's happening.
Well, but then also if you're Jen and you think, okay, you've got the money and you've sort of, we've been able to scrounge together what you came here to look for, you'd think that they'd be on their way. And if not, at least you've alerted people to call the police that you're expecting.
Police to come.
Someone to, like, the doors to be knocked in. Yeah. You know, you're expecting like a raid on the house. You're not. And I'm sure as this is happening, she's just pleading, like, will someone come in? Like,
yeah,
because I've already told somebody. It's not like nobody knows this is going on. Somebody knows that there's people in the home that should not be here.
Mm-hmm. My kids' lives are at risk.
And nobody comes. And nobody's there.
You come home and you hear, oh, something happened.
Oh.
Now it's your turn. And I think knowing that and being able to put yourself in those spots and how isolated and terrifying and just fucking violating this whole thing is, but how little Bill really knew of what was going on other than in his bones knowing it was wrong and hearing sounds kind of makes it more miraculous that Bill arose.
What?
Yeah. He is almost bled out. And he gets himself fucking untied and escapes from the basement.
Because for your wife and children, you will do anything.
Yeah. That's fucking adrenaline. He gets himself out of this basement and into his neighbor's lawn. He has no fucking clue what's happening. And he has no fucking clue that what woke him up was the rape and subsequent murder of his wife of over 20 years.
Oh.
His wife, who made him a father, who he met at this hospital working with pediatrics and knew in that moment that she knew more about caring for kids and being a nurse than he ever did. That it was his Jen who was the rock in raising their two beautiful daughters. One of which was going to follow in his footsteps and go to medical school. Mm. That was upstairs. And another with a heart so big, she couldn't let someone be not okay alone. And these are his girls. Those are the girls that are upstairs. And so he gets himself out. And he has no reality. He has no grasp on the reality that he should have been dead too. He just needs to help his girls.
Oh my God, I'm going to cry.
And so hearing the ruckus of Bill leave, Steve went into a fury and strangled Jen. to this day, both blame the other for what comes next, but evidence showed that they both played a role. The two used that gasoline they got from the gas station early that morning and spread it throughout the house, including on both Haley and Michaela.
No.
And lit the match.
No.
The house went up in flames, and unfortunately, both girls died as a result of the fire and being set on fire.
That is... I don't have words. That is barbaric. That is something that I would... Oh my God. Oh my God. I don't have words.
There are none. A detail that was particularly difficult for me was knowing that Haley at least was awake for some of this. There's evidence from the fire and the damage from the fire that she got up out of the bed and was walking around.
And she freed herself almost?
Yeah, I don't know if the fire
freed her,
broke the ropes or what, but yeah. And Michaela and her both died officially of the smoke inhalation and burns. Jen's cause of death was the asphyxiation and strangulation. As they're running away from this scene, the two piled into the family's SUV and attempted to run. But as the bank teller had called it in, the house had police outside of it already.
Go outside, go inside. They're inside, yes. Though.
Yeah. Yeah, they were inside.
They just killed everybody.
Yeah. But they got him.
No. That's not a win.
They piled into this SUV, and as they attempted to run, they crashed into a cop car on the way out. And were apprehended quickly. And I did write, is this a good time to say, Alexa, play Float On by Modest Mouse? No, sorry. I needed literally any levity, and that's all I had. Jen's sister later recounts this and said when she got the call that this had happened, the report was like, Bill survived. There was a fire. The girls are dead, but they caught the guys. And she was like, I don't give a fuck if they caught the, you know, like, that doesn't change anything.
No.
She didn't say that, of course. She was far more polite and well-spoken than I am, but she was like, what does that change? And she had to be the one to tell her parents.
So, there are so many parts of this I don't have words for, but my biggest frustration right now is that the police were waiting outside.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know following orders. I don't know what that protocol is. I'm not familiar with Plainville, Connecticut's police department.
Right, or their procedures for a hostage situation.
But I don't think watching the vehicle leave the bank and not stopping it or not approaching the house before they were reunited was a good idea. Or at the very least, as soon as they entered the home, you raid that shit. Because you own what happens in there now. If you're just waiting.
I don't know exactly when they got to the house versus when they did. But yeah.
But you should have been there at the house. There should have been a SWAT team in the woods. There should have been something going on. I don't know. And I guess you can't blame the individuals on the ground if they have to wait, like, they have to wait for that order. They can't go unless they're given permission to go. And I don't know what laws that is, so I'm trying to temper my frustration, but that is, if it could go the way I think it should have gone, there's no excuse as to why that didn't happen.
Yeah. And I will say I fully understand and respect the limitations of policy and procedure, and I get that. But this is a time when I feel like using discretion with the people who are there would be so beneficial, because there are not informal reports, but I've heard from multiple sources on this case that some of the first responders to arrive to the house heard screaming, which meant people were alive.
Yeah.
If you're screaming, you're breathing. Before I move all the way on, though, I do just want to say one other thing about Bill Pettit that thoroughly breaks my heart. He survives against literally all odds.
The wounds in his head didn't kill him.
Nope. And the blood loss didn't kill him either.
Wow.
He lost his wife, the love of his life, his two beautiful daughters, and home in a few hours.
In one day. That's how quickly it can change.
And he woke up at the hospital to Jen's parents. And the first thing he did was apologize that he couldn't save them.
Oh, come on.
I often make jokes and try to get myself through really hard cases like this by making fun of offenders or finding something fucking stupid to pick at or light to bring up, read the modest mouse issue. But the idea that this man escaped nearly dead, had to hear the most terrifying sounds a husband and a father could hear of your family being assaulted and murdered, stumble out nearly dead yourself and somehow make it on a gurney, and the first thing you do is fucking apologize, breaks my heart.
It's like he fought so hard to live, but he lost everything anyway.
Bill Pettit has a golden heart. And he astounds me still to this day. That being said, I need to move on a little bit, I think, or I'm going to sob like a lot. The trial for these cases was pretty insane. I'm not going to get into all of it because there's a lot of bullshit that went along with them. Mm-hmm. And I think that takes away from the loss that's experienced here. And I really don't want to do that. But there are a few things I feel like I should mention about it. First, there was a lot of public outcry at the way this was handled. Police were outside the residence. There was a hostage situation, and I know you can never take that lightly. You have to assess and all of that, but there might not have been three deceased girls inside that house when they first got there.
But the thing is there were anyway. So yeah. Anything you could have done to mitigate any of that would have been a fucking net positive here.
Right.
I know you don't know that, and that's only hindsight's 2020, and you're only looking back after the fact to know that, but I mean, what the hell?
Yeah. Exacerbating the public outcry was a lack of information. Of course, the media ran wild with this, but nobody from the police department was really releasing details. And it didn't help that a few months later during the court proceedings, a gag order was placed on anyone involved. The public also swarmed Steve and Josh's homes. Josh's family wasn't doing well at all with what happened, as you could imagine.
I don't know how you would.
They were shocked and knew he had an issue with burglary, but never imagined this level of horrid violence and violations he could have done.
That pastor was right. He is a pedophile.
Yep. Yeah. They retreated inwards, and with all of the media at their door, the only thing Josh's family could put out was this written statement that read, "This is an absolute tragedy. Our deepest sympathy goes out to the Pettit family and all those whose lives they touched. We cannot understand what would have made something like this happen. There is nothing else we can say at this time." Steve's brothers themselves hoped for the death penalty.
Yeah.
In the HBO Max documentary I watched, there was a slight bicker between two of Steve's brothers, actually, about it. Both of them were pro-death penalty for Steve, but one was saying he hoped that they didn't even get there and that Steve would be shot on the way into the courthouse. And the other said there's no chance they're going to let them kill the guy they want to kill.
Mm-hmm.
Which ended up kind of being true, in all honesty. He did not die going into the courthouse. Steve himself actually tried to take his own life while in custody.
That you often do.
They often do. Also, he has a history.
Mm-hmm.
This was not his first attempt by any means. And they wouldn't let him do that. And someone in the documentary made a comment that I thought was a bit thought-provoking, which was the notion that they were all trying to try these men to see if they could get a trial for the death penalty. Because, you know, that's how that works. You have to be found guilty and then,
mm-hmm.
you know, declared whether or not you'll get the death penalty. But that everybody wants him dead. mm-hmm. including himself.
Mm-hmm.
And they would rather draw this out than let him take his own life.
Yeah, because death was too easy a punishment for what he did.
Right. I think there's a lot of ways to look at that statement, but I think it's worth thinking about, you know?
Whatever he wants, I think you should get the opposite. So, you want that? No. You get a 10 by 10 cold concrete slab.
With your thoughts.
With your thoughts and all of the things that you've done. Because you're likely not able to go to general population because no. you're a pedophile. And typically...
That doesn't fare well.
Doesn't fare well. I mean, even though Steve wasn't...
Yeah, even though he didn't do anything pedophilic, the case itself did and he was involved in that. So he might have some equal consequence.
And he did enough that some of the other people are like, hey, I got kids. Like, you set kids on fire. Yeah. Like, you... That is the level of... depravity you reached.
Yeah
you're we've got no use for you here. Like, I could see that coming out in prison too.
And we'll talk a little more about that later, but I don't think either of them have been in Gen Pop in a very long time, mm-hmm. if ever. But this case obviously made huge news. Are you fucking kidding me? A quote-unquote burglary gone wrong turned into a triple homicide, double rape, and arson.
You know, and the thing is if Steve had taken his life when he wanted to.
That first time,
as awful as that would be, I'm never celebrating over somebody feeling that kind of pain. But had he, or had it not been that night and been a different night or something else... where he didn't stumble into a meeting where he ran into somebody. Like, their paths crossed at such a time.
Yeah.
When they were both so desperate that they actually had somebody that agreed with them.
Yeah.
Like, all of those circumstances had to happen just so for it to be the way that it was and for it to happen. Like, Michaela and Jen had to walk into that Stop and Shop that day at that time to be found.
Yeah. It's so random.
He had to see an 11-year-old that he thought had to be his. Like, they were probably up all night using or whatever it was. So, like, they're in a state of mind that isn't typical. Then doing this. Like, all of these very specific circumstances, that 10 or 15 minutes difference could have made all of the difference.
Yeah.
That it's just shocking. It is just shocking to me.
And I think it was shocking to everyone. I mean, how could it not be? It's so random. It's so niche. All of these things had to be just so. And for it to happen to this truly, like, kind of a pedestal of their community from these two men that
were not the pedestals of their community.
And, you know, I want to be noted, I don't know if they were using at the time of the crime, but obviously sobriety was not maintained throughout all of this.
Mm-mm.
But this rocked everyone's world in Cheshire. The Pettit family was that rock, though. Between active involvement in health and nursing and public safety and schools and athletics and MS foundations and more, they were so beloved. And a family friend noted that this was what the community referred to often as Cheshire's 9/11. That overnight, they went from this sort of idyllic small town American hometown, mm-hmm. to having people install alarm systems overnight in panic rooms that people weren't allowed into.
Yeah.
5 days after the crime, there was a funeral for Jen, Haley, and Michaela.
Oh my God.
Bill, who I literally cannot praise enough in this, standing in front of large photos in memory of his late wife and young children, with an unhealed head wound from his assault still showing, literally just thanked his community for showing up, for being there, for supporting him.
I can't even imagine what that room felt like.
It's a heaviness that I am glad I don't fully know the depths of, I think. Later in the documentary that I watched, Bill noted that this was a maddening system at best and how difficult that trial process was. Part of the issue with this being so well known is that it made jury selection a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You always try to find jurors that are unbiased or don't know much about what's going on. If you can, you know, if they have to know something, you'd rather they know nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
But they had 2,000 potential jurors and all of them knew about it. And all of them had negative feelings about Steve and Josh.
Yeah. And then I'd be concerned if you were like, nah, I'd grab a drink with them. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? But, and that's the thing we've talked about in other cases too. When these cases hit a community that like sends shockwaves through it, from every walk of life, you've read about it, you've heard about it, it's talked about. Oftentimes you can't avoid it. You can't avoid hearing something like that. That the kind of people that you get on a jury are the people that have stayed out of everything, like stayed out of civilization almost. Like they've got to really dig for people. And then you wonder, is this an accurate pool of our peers?
Right.
Because you're supposed to be judged by your peers. So you got to dig to find people that haven't heard of this. Is that jury pool
fair?
Is it effective? Is that, are you capturing the demographics that you aim to?
Right.
In this?
No. They didn't find anyone who didn't know about this case.
That's what I mean. And like, you can't.
75% of that 2,000, so 1,500 people were already like, yeah, kill him. We want him dead. See you never.
Mm-hmm.
They tried, the defense team tried to move the trial, but that was denied because they were like, this is fucking everywhere.
Right.
This is fucking everywhere. Like, where do you think you're going to go that they're not going to hear about these men that raped a family and lit them on fire?
For $15,000 that they already had.
Yep.
Yep.
So that wasn't permitted. And to save us the, I don't know, time, waste of breath on these two, eventually they were both found guilty.
Thank you.
Steven was found guilty on 16 out of 17 counts related to the invasion.
What was the one that didn't make the cut?
I'm probably Michaela.
Okay.
And Josh was found guilty of 17 of 17 counts related to the crime. Both men were sentenced to death until Connecticut vacated using the death penalty, finding it unconstitutional a few years later.
Mm.
Both men have now had their sentences transferred to multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole.
I'll take it.
Steven, in his time since, has come out as a trans woman and is now known as Linda Hayes. She has been diagnosed with gender identity dysphoria since, I think they said like 16, but she never was public or received hormone treatment. I have used Steven due to the timeline of all of this. But I just want it known that the ATFDC family like respects this treatment in its own form. But I don't really care about any of that right now.
No, it's got nothing to do with the case. Yeah.
The only aftermath that I really care with Hayes here is that her daughter, which she had a daughter, eventually became a police officer and is very proud of it.
Excellent.
Josh, in the time since, has faced his own struggles. It's so hard to find any care in my bones for him. He attempted to take his life by hanging himself, but did not complete that attempt. Josh has worked hard on appeals and has also been rejected at every turn, graciously, including a 7-0 rejection from Connecticut Supreme Court.
Yeah, you deserve absolutely fucking nothing, both of you.
Yeah. The other difference between Josh and Linda is that at least Linda has shown remorse. There has been a lot of remorse and apologies. It doesn't change what happened, but it's there.
I literally don't care.
I know. Me either.
You did some of the most horrendous, heinous things we've ever come across. You deserve no sympathy from me.
Oh, it gets worse. Because that's the only good thing between the two of them. Mm-hmm. Josh has written in his own diaries, which I think is silly, that he essentially blames Bill for not having saved his own family. Because how could you not?
Yeah, fuck it. Fuck him.
And he started calling Michaela the pet name her family used, KK. Which for me somehow is worse.
That is like blood boiling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The only other benefit here is that the two are in different prisons for the rest of their days. So they don't even have the solace of each other's company.
I know we're civilized and I know we're beyond this. And I say this every time. It's not that I want this and I don't want to live in a world like this. But if I could just imagine for a second that when you do something like that to somebody else, that that is what is done to you. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in this whole retribution thing on a mass scale, but like in these very specific circumstances.
It's hard to not go there.
Why could this not happen to them? Like, it's just, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not advocating for it. I'm just saying that like you can inflict that on somebody else and it took you years to reach some semblance of remorse, which is probably only used in some form of your appeals, that No. Nobody deserves that, but if you're willing to do that to somebody else, I think you're at the top of my list.
Yeah. I wouldn't cry about it. I'll put it that way. Ugh. As far as Bill, has gone on to do great things.
Of course he has.
Eventually remarried and having a son, Bill was involved in politics for a while. He ran and was elected for state house a few terms.
Wow, good for him.
I believe he has decided not to run again. I don't know if he ever will, but he did have a brief career there. But I believe that he deserves to gather himself how he sees fit. He has spoken out on his struggles with the system, his attackers, the death penalty as a whole, and he has given back to his community in so many ways. As far as Jen Hawks Pettit, Haley Elizabeth Pettit, and Michaela Rose Pettit, their aftermath lives on in their legacy and memories. Their community will never be the same without them. A charity, the Pettit Family Foundation, was created in their memory to help educate people, particularly in STEM, helping those with chronic illnesses, and helping people recover who are victims of violence. They have helped advocate and establish many funds and scholarships in the name of Jen and the girls at hospitals and schools, helped enrich their communities in many different ways, and they even created a youth award in the name of Haley and Michaela.
Oh my God, I'm going to cry.
If you do have any movement in your heart from this case, I am imploring you to take a look at this fund and see if there's any way you can donate time or money to help the constant fight of healing in the face of a tragedy like this. But dear listener, I have cried so many times writing this episode for you. This is a soul-sucking case that reminds me so much of the horrors of the world. That one day you can go to the store with your daughter and go home to your loving kids and husband, read a book with your daughter, kiss your husband goodnight in hopes he'll come up after he's done just resting his eyes, and turn out the lights for your almost so grown-up daughter who's about to leave home.
Who's reading Harry Potter and fell asleep reading it. I did that.
Yeah. You can curl into bed with whatever book she's on of the series, and then a few hours later, everything is ripped away. It's random, it's needless, it's violent, it's horrid. It's a shining example of the innumerable challenges of our justice system and the appeals and the fight everyone has a right to. It shows the existential crisis and outcry of people who did the most horrid thing and finding, as a justice system, the humanity in us not to propel the violence that we detest, and the grief and anger that comes with all of those decisions, too. But this case is also a reminder of the American dream. Bill went on Oprah and talked about what it's like to have everything before bed and wake up to no family or home, naked on a gurney in a hospital.
Oh my goodness.
He struggled with PTSD and suicidal ideations, as I think absolutely anybody would after something like this. And he's noted that the reason that he doesn't hurt himself or take his own life is because he so strongly believes he's going to see his girls again one day. He knows what it's like to have to make the decision to give up or keep going. Not just in the moment that he decided to get up, escape, and find help for himself and his family, but also in the times and the days afterwards where he decided he wasn't giving up. In the new family he's built, while honoring the family he was ripped away from, he has been vocal, given back to his community, and dared to move forward. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of people could use a refresher on. We always try to take what we can from these cases, and in such absurd and horrid random terror, it always makes it hard. There's no misstep, no change in policy or idea I can give you to give you a sense of safety and rest assured that this kind of chaos will never be in your life. But if I can give you anything out of this, it's a reminder to live for the people you love. And if you're fortunate and misfortunate enough to be a survivor, to not let those tragedies kill you. Remember your people often, love them with every moment you have, and put one foot in front of the other when that's all you can do. It is the hope, it's the love, the integrity, and the earnestness that has created any value I've found in my life. And it is my hope that your love and integrity fills your life so that when raging shitstorms of unimaginable trauma like this hit, we can find some solace in what we were able to do with the time we have together and how we can fuel that to connect us after our time is over. If you found this big or important or hard, I really want to shout out that documentary on HBO called Cheshire Murders, although I think you can get it on YouTube for free. It was incredibly thoughtful and informative, as was the Medium article that I read. But please don't forget to look in the show notes where you can find that fund for the Pettit family, and also go to our Instagram and look at those beautiful faces of all of them. That's what I have for you today.
I think I said all of the things that have come to mind that I'm willing to say out loud.
Yeah, this is a hard one.
These cases always hit different too when it feels like there is so little, if anything, that could have been done differently for it to have gone a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Someone really wants into your house, they're going to get in.
Yeah.
If somebody really wants to hurt you, they're going to look for a way. And that is terrifying.
Of course.
And it's what can you best do to arm yourself with knowledge or tools or anything like that, a security system, cameras, doesn't stop it as it happens, but it could be a deterrent.
Yeah.
Of someone seeing, oh, well, I see those lights, I know what that means.
Maybe I'll try somewhere that doesn't.
Which is awful, because if it's not you, it's somebody else, but if everyone does that, then hopefully it's nobody.
Right.
It does remind me of the Mount Vernon case that we covered way in the beginning.
Yes.
Where I'm pretty sure I ugly cried through most of that. But the randomness of it, that a man went on a business trip and came home to his daughter fighting for her life and his wife having been murdered because people wanted to break into a house and kill someone to find out what it feels like.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do with the kind of person that goes through life feeling that way toward others, but I certainly don't want them around me.
No.
But I hope they stay in prison forever. I hope they have no good days. I don't care what you apologize for, remorse you feel, you did that, you own that, you made your bed.
Yeah.
That's it. I am a very kind, patient person, I'll say that, but when it comes to stuff like this, you break into someone's home, you assault them, you tie them up, you sexually assault them, you steal from them, and you set them on fire, including their home, because you wanted money. Which obviously wasn't all that you wanted.
Right.
But you come in and you take that entitlement, that thought process is something I could never relate to. Those neurons don't fire in my brain. Those synapses don't connect. I'm not wired that way. And it is unfathomable to think that you could be that you believe that you are owed or deserving of somebody's home, what they've worked hard for, their bodies, their sense of innocence or comfort or safety in their home. You can take that from somebody.
And I think that it's just, I think about this and there's no chance in my brain that this was truly intended to just be a burglary. I don't know. Maybe with Josh it always was, and then it spiraled when he got left alone, or maybe not, because he picked out the family because he thought the 11-year-old was cute. I don't know.
He went there with that
in his
mind. Is that's because you found somebody that you were attracted to and followed them home. What happens next isn't an accident.
No. And what, nothing that fucking happened here was an accident. And I think the hardest part of all of this is seeing all of the premeditation. They went and got that gasoline before 9 a.m.
They knew what they were going to do. You didn't just sneeze and light a match. Come on.
Nope. And I don't know. And in this case, everybody, you can even think to put yourself in the shoes of, is gut-wrenching, like ruining. But I also think about Haley, because she just had to sit there and listen to all of it.
Mm-hmm. And then probably wondered when it was going to happen to her.
Yeah.
And then instead, the next person she sees is somebody dumping gasoline. Like, you know that she thought it. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What is that? Why? Don't do that. Like, ugh.
Yeah.
No, I don't have words. And I need to go look through our pod pets.
Yeah.
That's which you can call. Do on our Instagram. You can see it in our link tree. I have to plug that, yeah. Especially here, because we could all use something not so heavy.
Yeah.
And our beautiful, wonderful pod pets that are in the ATFTC fam. Yeah. I love them.
They're so good. And you guys, I'm so sorry that this is the case I had, but you know, Bill Pettit lived through it. And three other women didn't get the chance to. So we're going to talk about it and it's going to suck. And now I'm just asking you all to give your pod pets and your people the biggest hugs and little boops on the snoots and cheek kisses and spend that quality time now, you know?
And take a look at the Pettit Family Foundation that we will have linked in the show notes. And come ready next week for another case. More fun that you get to hang out with us.
Ayo.
We're in our fat pants right now and chilling with blankets over our shoulders and braving the cold, and we love getting to hang out with you every week. This is the best part of my week.
Hanging out with you guys is the highlight for sure.
We love you guys.
Take care of yourselves. Please spend some time on you this week. And if I do take a look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.